4, which puts it on a pretty severe level, but it didn't seem to be very long. And that may be one of the things that saved it from becoming even worse. However, it was pretty strong, 7.4. And let's see, on the other side of the ocean from Japan, who's still getting shook up every once in a while.
What about tsunamis?
Yeah. Well, no tsunami, though. Yeah.
And I guess it's probably still too early to tell, but I hope, pray to God, we're not talking about something like what happened in Haiti.
Oh, well, you mean Haiti had...
Well, I mean, on that scale, how many hundred, there's 200,000 people in Haiti in the last earthquake? Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
What's Do you think that it will be similar in Mexico?
No, I don't think, well, the reports are not anywhere near that. No, not at all. It's almost like it didn't happen. Yet, it did. I'm not sure why. I think the tremor, there are different kinds of quakes, however. And this seemed to be one that... The shaking wasn't quite as, I guess, the movement wasn't as long, the wave wasn't as long, I guess, so. But then again, maybe they've already made areas much stronger than before. However, only recently hit, but it seemed to be not by Mexico City, but Acapulco, so a different area, but still pretty close.
Do you think this is just one in many earthquakes that have happened through history, or do you think this has any significance at this time of history, I guess, in the 2012 era?
Well, actually, any of the earthquakes, as they continue to mount up, having earthquake and a volcanic eruption close by and continued movement around, and the Ring of Fire just really is on fire, moving. There's a lot of movement around, and that, of course, is something that keeps your antennas up, actually, keep looking around, because it's if it seems to be stable, then it goes and it comes and it goes. It's somewhat normal and perhaps even good. But if it continues to increase in its energies, then it could be quite cataclysmic in terms of what can happen. But right now, the Mexico one seems to have been strong, but without devastation. So that's good.
Well, and if the same magnitude would happen under L.A. or Tokyo or Stockholm, well, hopefully in Acapulco, I've never been there myself, but I wouldn't think it's quite the dense population that, many of our urban centers are.
Yeah, but according to some of the witnesses, they still... at street level, we're able to watch the building sway in New Mexico City. So that's not to say that the buildings are going to come down, but at least you could see them moving around, which is pretty much of a shake. And it tells you that their buildings are also in pretty good shape.
Yeah, usually, and I don't want to say Mexico's a third world country. Maybe they're a second world country. They're certainly not. You guys can send hate mail, but I don't think they're... necessarily a first world country, and you would see these shoddier building practices in these different types of countries, like we've seen before when the buildings collapsed because they were not constructed to withstand earthquakes in the first place.
Yeah, well, buildings that tend to fall down have no sheer strength. They tend to just be piled up, basically heaps of rubble with actually, just held together with a little bit of mortar, and not the right kind of concrete. And they tend to fall apart with a little bit of shaking. But most of the modern structures, of course, can't be built that big without putting in the right geometry and the right reinforcement, of course, which is usually steel. Now these are adding counterbalances and things like that to buildings, which are very interesting. Yet it was something that was added. And, you know, some of those old pagoda towers in Japan, they've got a counterbalance in them.
No kidding, really?
Yeah, it's a huge pole that sits inside that seems to really serve no purpose, but just to be hanging in there, you know, in these pagodas that have been there. And, you know, you think, well, an earthquake should have knocked this place down a long time ago, but they never fall down because of that pendulum that sits inside of them. And now that, of course, is being reworked for modern buildings in Japan. And Japan has a lot of interesting designs on earthquake-proofing their buildings, besides just making them strong.
Well, that is one of the things that engineering science can, hopefully, accomplish. That would seem to be a testimony to that fact. Someday, after there's a large event in a major American city, we'll see how those modern-day engineers' counterweights actually worked. It's an ingenious idea, but boy, we don't think about this. You know, today's engineers think that this was a newly discovered idea, yet it's thousands and thousands of years old.
Yeah, at least, you know, with the pagodas I saw in Japan, they're hundreds of years old, and you know, they're pretty interesting in terms of how they had foresight enough to put them in there. And this is something I remember quite, you know, thinking that, wow, somebody actually thought of this, or was it just their own idea, you know?
And even hundreds of years ago, how did you understand wave tectonics or the way earthquake waves move through the Earth's crust? How could they possibly have understood that and then devised a way to counteract that?
Yeah, and especially putting them in these pagodas, which tend to be temples, you know. And temples, of course, and the priesthood originally, many of the priesthood and the temples around the world were supposedly depositories of ancient knowledge and wisdom. And who knows if some of it was engineering technology that had been lost because maybe the way it was handed down and may have been only in paper. When I went to Sim Reap, which is these ancient temples, and they kind of date them toward the early Middle Ages. Actually, they're not that old, according to someone, but there's so many other older temples around Sim Reap that indicate that they're much older. Indicates also that a lot of their ancient knowledge was lost because they were written on basically paper or something that could needed to be transcribed rewritten because much of it, except for that which was etched in stone, was basically lost. And they said, asked historians what they knew about it, and they said, we don't know anything, simply because all we know is we have the room, and the rooms show that this is a storage of knowledge, and you know how large the room was. It was essentially like a library. And if you were to think that, well, if they stored in there things that just went around so people could walk around in there, and they may have some shelves, this sure must have had quite a bit of knowledge considering the size of the room that held this knowledge. So a lot of it was lost. So they just said, we had a lot of knowledge that has been lost, and we wish we knew what it was.
Well, like the burning of the libraries at Alexandria, you know, what knowledge was lost when they burned all of the Mayan books but four?
Yeah.
All of them. Way to go, priests. Good job. Let's destroy an entire civilization's worth of knowledge because somebody told you to do so. So is it possible then, maybe a couple of hundred years from now, after we've completely gotten away from paper and everything is now ones and zeros on magnetic data, what if there was a mass coronal ejection that wiped out all that data? Could all of the knowledge of our civilization just be lost like it was in the fire at Alexandria?
It is something I have always wondered about. And it indeed could happen if a mighty discharge. You know, one of the things that there's been theorized is in terms of some of the problems our early solar system had was these massive electrical interchanges between celestial bodies that passed in the night, you might say. And of course, we've got this idea of Nibiru, Planet X, coming near planet Earth. Now, we're not only looking for a coronal mass ejection, but along with that streaming charged particles, we're also looking at this idea, perhaps, that if there was a tremendous static discharge of electrical energy, that could cause a lot of problems if it wasn't properly associated with some type of grounding or essentially absorbing energy away from where they're stored. We've got massive data storage areas today that are being used not only by just recently by the public, but they have been used by various entities, government or private, storing much of the information in multiple locations to try to make sure that the data is properly stored and archived in locations which are safe. But who knows what is safe in terms of mighty actions that can happen in terms of the types of celestial discharge that happen between large celestial bodies, let's say our planet Earth and a very large comet or something that passes by. Doesn't have to hit, just get close by.
It's the same principle as rubbing your socks and then touching somebody on the carpet and then touching somebody.
Exactly.
What's the difference? I mean, it's not hard to rationalize.
Mm-hmm. And what it was said was that these things did take place, and in association with what we're already witnessing is these audible sounds, trumpetings, and then of course comes the thunderings and the lightnings, which are also associated. But prior to the discharges, there were these audible sounds, these trumpetings that were heard and recorded by the ancients.
What do you think if we were standing in a crowd of Mayans back from the day, but they were teleported to the year 2012? Here we are at the spring equinox. Today is taping of this show. It's live, I should say, the live airing is the 20th of March. This is the equinox, if I understand it, is that there's equal amounts of light today, right? There's the same 12 hours of light, 12 hours of darkness.
Right, yeah.
And moving towards the 21st of June, where we will have the longest day of the year. But what if the Mayans were with us today? What if they were here in the studio and they were looking at the calendar and they're going, oh my goodness, today's the 20th of March, 2012. Would they be, in your opinion, in an excited state? Would they be, you know, covering their heads with their hands? Would this be an emergency situation, or would it be like the world is treating it, just another day on the calendar that will pass and the times will change thereafter?
Well, I think that the priesthood, especially the priesthood who were knowledgeable enough to have had at least transcribed the calendar, and from apparently from what the celestial sent me, it wasn't their design. It was an earlier design that came from the Toltecs, I believe. But it could have been even earlier in terms of that long count calendar. And these who were keepers of that knowledge would be the ones who would be essentially reactionary toward that. And well, we know what the Mayans were. They were kind of bloodthirsty. They had a blood cult. So I'm sure that they would have been China react in one way or another, something similar to what we know in their history.
You know, you watch a movie of the Titanic, for instance, which is probably fairly historically accurate, where the people are just casually walking towards the lifeboats. You know, they have no idea that a whole bunch of them are about to die. Are we the same thing? Are we just oblivious to this or not?
It could very well be, because in certain stages of the change or the turning, there's very little to be concerned about. It seems like everything can continue and progress as normal. In fact, biblically, it was said, as in the days of Noah, so it shall be in the coming of the Son of Man. The idea that during Noah's days, people were just going around life as if everything was not going to change, and sitting with a warning that was quite obvious of this one character building a gigantic ark, chopping down a forest and harvesting a bunch of tar, you know, and putting something together. And even with that, they just continued on as if nothing would happen. And of course, interestingly enough, I look at what Zachariah Sitchin was able to dig up about the concept of the flood, which was, according to the Sumerian writings, a tremendous ice sheet that slid off the top of Antarctica and pushed its way into the sea, creating a vast tsunami that worked its way right up Africa and right up into the Middle East, and just washed over everything. And of course, we know what was said did happen in the tsunami in Japan. The tsunami in Japan, after the earthquake, the ground, the fountains of the deep fountains of the earth did break. There's pictures of people actually videotaping how the water seeped out of the ground, and some places springs broke open and just water started pouring out, and in the liquefaction in some areas. And then at the tsunami, as the tsunami approached, there was a tremendous wind, a tsunami wind that blew in inland. And this is a similar thing that happened in recorded concept of Noah's flood. And that tells me that there is at least some credibility to the historic documentation of the people around the world who did lay, perhaps, reed to paper or whatever it may be, or a stylus to clay to record some of this information. And it seems that some of the hints that were laid forward in terms of this type of calamity coming here again, repeating, and those are the loud acoustical phenomena running around the planet. And then, of course, the inclement weather and types of electrical discharges that would be unique, perhaps, ones that are more than just the effects of these auroras that are, of course, quite beautiful to look at, but at the lower latitudes, you know, these things are showing up quite nicely because of the way the sun is behaving. The sun is not necessarily really active, but essentially throwing out bits of itself every once in a while.
You make an interesting point about the wind in front of the tsunami that I never really heard of or thought about, but well, anyone that stood alongside a highway when a semi-truck went past, you get blasted pretty hard. And that's something that's a little smaller than a tsunami and a hell of a lot thinner. Imagine if that semi's, what, about 8 feet wide? Well, the tsunami's, I don't know, 1,000 miles wide?
Yeah.
And it's going a lot faster than that semi? And it's got to, of course it has to push the air. I never even thought about that till you mentioned that today.
Yeah, and there was actual video of a van one of the lighter truck, Japanese-type vans that were blown over by the wind that preceded the actual water coming in. So these historic documentation of stories of the wind and, you know, things and all of these have credence. They have some real credibility in terms of comparing it to actual events that are happening right now. Another thing that I continue to observe is how the volcanism planet-wide is supposed to be on the increase. It's one of the things that was shown to me. So this, of course, would cause a different kind of effect in our atmosphere. And it may be happening, I'm not sure, but there's more cooling going on around. And conceptually, we may also be heading into another kind of mini ice age, perhaps.
Well, let me tell you about the ice age thing right now. In northeastern Ohio, where Artist First is located, today's the 20th of June. It was 20th of March. It was 82 degrees today. In the studio, I have the windows open, and if I look over my shoulder, it's 81.9 degrees. There should be snow on the ground. It has been in the 70s for the last 7 or 8 days, and it's forecasted to be in the 70s for the next 7 or 8 days. We're used to big snowstorms this time of year.
Yeah, where did it go? Well, there is a theory about that concept is how the warm weather is hitting areas where cold used to be in. The cold is going to areas a little further over toward Europe side because of the magnetic North Pole moving a bit and taking along with that a bit of the climate. It could be true because, of course, that would be magnetic currents that help guide perhaps the jet stream here or there. And that, of course, the jet stream is the cold influencer of a lot of our weather, especially when it dips down. And that has given terrible cold weather toward Europe side. Well, you guys have been enjoying a little bit more warmer weather. However, there is some, you know, colder weather, even in our United States, in Alaska. Sierra is also having some heavier snowfalls.
Well, Michael, what you were talking about earlier, let's say there's going to be an event, and let's say it's Yellowstone, a super volcano, and it's going to explode. I don't want to say our celestial friends are incapable of doing anything. Maybe they could control that. They've told us on other occasions they've stepped in to help us when they could. Now, something on that cataclysmic scale. Okay, they're at the sun working on problems. This shouldn't be that big of a deal. But what if, let's just hypothetically talk about this for a second. What if on August 1st, Yellowstone's going to blow and they know it? Can they stop it?
Well, in something like that, I've been made aware that there is a limit to what they will do because offsetting Yellowstone would, of course, mean impressing something elsewhere. And sometimes the payoff is no different. In other words, the cure is just as bad as the actual explosion. So this is something that... they look at, definitely.
Well, and what is the population? Even if every single American was killed, what's the population? We're 7% of the Earth's population is Americans? Well, it would seem like a big problem to us. The rest of the world,
Well, that's actually quite true.
And 7%,
who cares? The cities that have been in the... that's not in the old world, in Europe, but let's say in Asia, they're built up with all pretty modern stuff. And, you know, they look really nice because they're relatively recently structured and engineered up to the kind of specification as we're talking about earthquake proof and all this other stuff, using newer materials, and you know, being in Malaysia, looking at the Petronas towers being that much stainless steel used actually structurally as well as architecturally, was just amazing to see, and the surrounding buildings all being up to date, and a tremendous amount of structures being constructed relatively new. They have a whole different economy outside of the United States and Europe.
Well, I was glad to see that Greece came to some agreement with its private and Euro banks, and we've avoided something there. However, the that may have made things exponentially worse for Spain and the rest of the countries that are going to be facing those types of difficulties. You know, I think we dodged a real bullet there. People get bored with economics as soon as you start talking about it. But if Greece would have gone under, so would have a whole bunch of European banks and a whole bunch of American banks. That particular case seems to have been solved. Now, who's as I mentioned, Spain's the next culprit. But are we past this, or is this going to be a never-ending series of, we got to bail this one out and this one out and this one?
Well, one of the good examples of what happens when you do something like that instead of letting them fail is Japan's economy. Japan has not recovered from their initial burst and bubble economy, and they did something very similar, and they are pretty much wallowing around. You know, they're still there, and people are, thinking back, to the times in which the economy was running somewhat more normal, but it's been basically an economy that is sluggish and somewhat sick because of what they've done, and this is probably the kind of economy that bailing out will bring about, something that isn't as vital as if you let the banks themselves fail.
Well, I may have I didn't think of Italy. I think Italy's the next one. They got to these economies. It's not like Goldman Sachs failing. It's an entire country failing.
Right.
And, while listeners may not care about economics, these types of problems can be the end of civilization. When the money's gone and you don't have any way to buy food and there's no gasoline, it doesn't take many days till the whole thing just unravels. And when you are hoping that some bureaucrat in Greece or Italy or Spain gets it together to prevent the rest of us from our lives completely disintegrating, gives you another more stuff to stay awake at night, right, Michael?
Well, yeah. Well, in a sense, watching the economic engine turn was something that was actually pretty well documented, even in the Book of Revelation, in terms of the Great War, which is the typified economies of the world, and this type of consumerism and banking system and trade that went on, and the kings of the planet or the rulers of the planet having to do with illicit sex and fornication with this great whore, which is basically the world economy. And watching, seeing some of the things actually play out, seeing a little bit of the remnant of the story of the ships of the sea, the captain said, in one hour, all this stuff come to naught. And they look at the pictures of how it actually stopped economic flow of credit, stopped the shipping, and Singapore being one of the busiest areas in the world, as far as the busiest harbor in the world is, I think, Singapore. And just nothing but ships anchored out there, just lights that went on for just hundreds of major ships, container ships, just waiting to load and having nothing to put on them because credit stopped. And, that's how it was written in the Book of Revelation. And from the Book of Revelation, it looks absolutely horrible. Absolutely, like the whole world was going to end, but you have to piece it out and pull it out and then look and see for yourself what is being played out, and it is indeed being played out, and the demise of the great whore is coming to pass, as its function is really that financial system that runs the planet. You know, and the old concept of buying buying things you don't need with money you don't have, that type of mentality is pretty much being erased right now.
Boy, if anybody that watches cable TV sees all these brand new shows that are on about people building bunkers and how they're storing their equipment and explosion, of course, that's, I suppose, to be expected in the spring of 2012. The television producers are cognizant of what the public wants to hear about. Or are they? Is this a sinister thing? How come there's 10 times more shows about the end of the world, ancient aliens, and how to survive holocausts or, you know, huge disasters? Is that just commercial TV?
Well, it's on the hearts and minds of people, and that's how things work. I mean, it tends to sell advertising space, too. What one looks at that is not being said is the warning and what to do. And it was sort of a hard concept, and maybe I should teach on that concept a little bit as it came to me in being taught by the Celestials themselves. It says, those who will save their lives shall lose them, and those that lose their lives, and it was in Christ's teaching, for my sake, shall save it. What was this teaching all about? And this is where, you know, building these shelters and, you know, saving your life, you'll actually lose it. And the concept of losing your life, what was that all about? Well, one of the things that was very important in terms of my trip to the New Jerusalem, that mighty city or gigantic mothership orbiting Saturn, was that it's a grand school. It's a tremendous area for intergalactic exchange right now. And that exchange happens to be in knowledge and training for many of the citizenry of the universe that we are a part of. And we just happen to be within a local system called Satania. But this is a key area because it's a fallen area, yet allowed to come back. But allowed to come back in a way that sort of tries to answer itself. But again, many times plays out the correct wisdom. And the wisdom of losing one's life for the sake of God is really the teaching that I received, because the divine fractal, a little bit of God that is placed on every sentient person on planet Earth, needs to be contacted and needs to be contacted with sincerity. That sincerity is an exact opposite, retro opposite of the direction in which a normal person would take in terms of saving their lives. Because you're looking at providing yourself with tools that are good for saving your physical life, perhaps, and knowing full well that that will eventually fail. However, what the Celestials have in store for us is able to be actuated by an opposite direction. And that direction is an inward attunement toward divinity, that very divinity which is within every human being that treasures truth and right and wrong. And that attunement is one of the very entry points, perhaps, one of the very characteristics that are used by the Celestials, who will actually save the individual soul, the individual. It's not desired that any, not even one individual be lost because of careless carelessness on their part. But the essentially the infidelity toward the first source and center, the divine fractal within us, can lead us in strange ways, because it's only going to lead us toward obvious things that we think are going to be good for us in terms of, you know, stashes of food, bits of tradable goods, and metals and commodities like gold or silver, having some water. But having a little bit is not too bad, because of the fact that there will be some things that may happen that may interrupt localized areas. But when it comes down to the actual wave that comes through and hits the planet, along with this wave is a type of energy that we don't know nothing about. And I was introduced, quite frankly, to that in terms of this bush that was, or a plant that was outside of the classroom that I intended in. And symbolizing, of course, this type of material, the teacher who stood next to me pointed out that this plant, he didn't really call it a plant. It looked like a plant, like a bush, but it radiated beautiful light, and it seemed to move in ways that even a physical person couldn't move, and a beautiful dance that it did in appreciation of how I looked at it. And it was simply said that it was made of material that was not found on Earth, yet material that was real. And being a kid that I was, I repeated, "You mean plastic?" And then, of course, I didn't get the point. But I do remember the point being that this type of energy and this type of material called Marantia material will be introduced to our planet at a time, and only to individuals who have attuned themselves toward that. And one of the things that is very interesting about what we possess, we have one bit of that type of Marantia material that we possess, and animals don't possess it. It's called our soul, and it is a transitory piece between the physical and the spiritual, someplace in between that can span both. It is a material in which was demonstrated to me in terms of how things work. In fact, some of the material in which their very ships that took me to the planet have the type of Marantia ability. And a lot of it having to do with the Marantia capability, it has a lot to do with dimensional shifting, as well as having qualities that are not physical at all, having more spiritual qualities. And this attunement that brings about the resonance with that is something like tuning in ahead of time to the program that will be played at that time, which will really bring about that transitional shift in terms of the human body, the human being. It will, in many cases, result in the decomposition of the physical body in terms of its transition, but not in terms of life, real life. It will be something that actually is a transition toward immortality. And that is one of the things that this plant that was outside of their room, this plant that was alive but really wasn't alive, was more than alive, and radiated not only light but feeling and emotion and love. All of those characteristics are part of the energy that will be shared at the time on this transition. So this little warning that came out by Christ himself, saying, "He that saved his life at that time will lose it, he will lose his life." And that diametric dimension directly opposite in terms of trying to save your life is building your soul. And that warning, which was placed by Christ to some individual that said, I've done well, and got a lot of harvest, got big barns full of stuff, and so what are you going to do now? So I'll just continue to do the same and just build bigger barns and more place to store that stuff. And then basically came down and said, you're a fool, because this day your soul will be required of you, and you have nothing structured. You don't have an attunement. You don't have nothing. And nothing salvable is there. Essentially, you built nothing. So the direction that was headed, that individual was headed, was truly only temporal, only toward this life, and not toward the true and everlasting Warancha life. And that is beyond many of the understandings of even the UFO people who look for what is classified as extraterrestrial biologic entities, and that Ebens, this concept of Ebens, is biology is very different when you look at it in terms of the Marantia sense. It's, the material is not even biologic. It has the type of organic basis, you know, carbon base or biologic base even, in terms of self-replication. It's very different. So our initiation toward this solid journey, this solid place of immortality, does not use the biologic. The biologic is nothing but scaffolding in which is used to really build the for real stuff, the stuff that really lasts, which is, I guess, placed outside of the classroom to emblaze within me that knowledge. And that very same plant was the very one that called Moses to the top of the mountain, which was that bush that burned called him up there. And also he received audible understanding and reception of physical nature in terms of receiving the Ten Commandments. Those things are real, and much more than a hearsay. Also at the time of Moses was, again, the acoustic trumpeting and thunderings and lightnings. So these things are all part of it, and they remained through their journey. So it continued on for a while. It wasn't just a short period of time.
You're listening to Project Urantia. If you're a first-time listener, a whole bunch of shows are listed at the website. Michael is also available at Hello Earth with Curtis Cooperman, HelloEarth.net. Did I get that right? Hello Earth. What's the web address?
HelloEarth.info.
HelloEarth.info. And he's also on BroadcastUrantia.com. There's lots of information. Get out there. Take it in, see what you think. Are you ready for a couple emails?
Yeah, okay.
Our first one comes in, breaking news. Pfizer found and patented Marantia material, and Monsanto will be its only worldwide licensed manufacturer.
Sounds just like the concept of them taking over everything. But actually, when it came down to the celestials themselves really looking at what we've been doing to our planet, they don't appreciate our tempering with ourselves or even the life in ways that are outside of just normal, you know, tinkering around with crossbreeding and things like that. This is something that when Monsanto does it, I was made aware in some of my earlier experience how they did it, because where I lived on Molokai was one of their top sites where they developed types of corn there. And that woman, who's I'm not going to mention her name, but she was a little woman, and actually looked a little bit scary because she had a little kind of way of walking that seemed like she wasn't quite all that healthy. But in discussion was that she was the one that did the bombardment of the chromosomes to blast in the genetic modifiers into the corn structure that would be sent around the world, different types of seed corn. And it has to be made that way every single time. It's not a crossbreed. It is a splice that is made artificially, So there's no crossbreeding. It's a freak of nature. It's not a freak of nature. It's a freak of that doctor who actually manipulated the design. So it's placing foreign genotypes into, let's say, the corn plant. And basically it was to keep certain plants Roundup ready, but also Roundup being that type of herbicide, which is systemic. Essentially, the herbicide will get it within the system of a plant and destroy it. But if certain plants who had a certain gene were immune to it, and this gene was thrown into the other plants, and but it along with it, during that bombardment, other alien genes get spliced in. And it's caught a lot. People might say, well, that's a bunch of junk, but it actually comes out in the end. So when you look at Monsanto and their early developments and use of something like that to create a profit base and uniqueness, they've done a tremendous amount of damage. Of course, they will never be able to do this because they don't even have any idea what Mancha material is.
And remember, folks, as history has demonstrated so clearly, the health of the civilization doesn't matter. The food you intake, if it's poisonous, doesn't matter. What matters is the profits of companies like Monsanto. Deal with it. They are far more powerful than most governments, and of course they have our government under their thumb.
Yeah.
Oh, from Matt in Oroville, Ohio, he writes, first of all, Matt, privately about your first question, yes, we do, and it's only cost us half the price it did back then. Number two, did you get the feeling the royal most high purple-robed beings were both male and female together?
No, actually not. I felt they were somewhat gender neutral. However, seemingly more more male than female in terms of their attitudes, the way they behaved, they spoke, their posture, maybe their posture. But having one of the things that's very interesting is that those that wear purple robes in modern time walk single file and have a similar demeanor of all things Buddhist monks. Different colored robes being for different sects of Buddhism. There's yellow robes, and there's, depends where you're from, but in Japan, these Buddhist monks that seem to look just, don't behave very similarly, have purple robes, and they walk with their purple robes in single file, and are more sophisticated, I guess, in the way we as humans chant, let's say, a sutra, a long Buddhist sutra. One of maybe a famous one would be, not to mention it. I guess I'm told not to mention it. But it's just, you know, just a story that Buddha wrote and repeated and chanted. Those that I promised to help did a very similar type of chant, but the result was a tremendous amount of purple, bluish, what looked like incense or smokiness coming from the tops of their head, emanating from there. And it filled the room with a light that was very close to that purplish blue color. And it enveloped me. And the closest I could come was in terms of the ancients, besides the Buddhists, having a lot of incense in their ceremonies. Also, the Jewish have a lot of incense, but they have the holies of holies, and one of the things of the Shekinah glory. The Shekinah glory was the presence of deity, the presence of divinity. Well, that was experienced by me, but not here on earth, actually. It's a type of Marantia experience, of Marantia gases, Marantia expressions of material, spiritual, having this type of energy, and it was translated and experienced by me physically. So I begin to understand that they have been influencing our planet. And as a matter of fact, getting back to Simri, I did find a picture of these types of Buddhas, essentially carved in a similar fashion into the walls in Siem Reap, and having these multiple entities there who were enlightening their chosen area of enlightenment, which is, I guess, at the time, Siem Reap was a major producer of agri-goods, which was basically rice for all Southeast Asia. It was tremendously wealthy in terms of that, and perhaps had the technology to produce it beyond the level in which it's produced today. But that was, again, so that the people could get off of their basic grubbing around and trying to work out an existence and get attuned. And some did, but still a lot have a hard time. But again, the same message is going out as it did then. He that saves his life will lose it, but he that loses his life has things taken care of by then, basically things necessary for life taken care of. Then you can turn and actually start attuning. And that's what they came to teach, and that's what I've come to teach in terms of the very same philosophies and realities that will express themselves in people's lives beyond their normal span of life.
Well, there's one more email I'm hoping we can squeeze in, if you can answer it in like 15 seconds, and it reads, Michael, will life be the same on 3/2013/3/2014 as it is today?
3, actually, it's a continual changing process. So if you were to ask me that, sure. I mean, it's not the same as we progress forward. It keeps expanding because the influence has gone beyond the level of being influenced by just outward events. There are actual celestial interchange happening with those who are gaining attunement. And there's those that are actually trying to get the attention of people and shouting out numbers at particular times. And a person does see those numbers. Generally, the number is 1111. And they get that, oh, what was that all about? And they keep, that means they're being, they're part of a group that can hear. And it's, that reminds me, he that hath an ear, hear what the Spirit says unto you. Hear what the Maranchat, or those who are transitioning, can say to you. So this listening is going to get more and more results as people begin to understand what they're listening to.
And folks, that's why we do this program. You can think we're a bunch of idiots. That's okay. But think about it. Rationale it out, think about what we're talking about, and arrive at your own decisions. We're not trying to persuade anyone. We're simply putting out the information there for you to digest and come up with your own conclusions. I want to mention on every broadcast that Michael has nothing to sell. The gentleman in Orrville, Ohio, wanted to know what the bandwidth cost. Let me tell you, it cost a bunch, but thank God it's a half of what it was 5 years ago because prices have come down. We do not sell advertising on this program. We do this program because Artist First feels this information is very important for the public to hear, and we get a tremendous. Our audiences are in the hundreds of thousands at this broadcast, and we are thrilled at the success of this show and honored that the Celestials would choose this platform to get out some of their messages. Michael, again, on behalf of all of our listeners, thank you so much for your time every week that you spend with us.
Okay, and aloha. Thank you very much.
Everybody, Artie Kornfeld's coming up in about 2 minutes. You are listening to the Artist First Radio Network. Thanks for joining us, everyone.